This audio interview with Tony Mooney was recorded on 18 September 2018 in Cowra by Nikkei Australia's Mayu Kanamori and Masako Fukui. This interview was recorded for the Cowra Voices geolocative storytelling app, created in 2019 and launched to coincide with the 75th anniversary of the Cowra breakout. For more information, please refer to the overview in this archive.
Tony Mooney is my name, and I'm a director of the Japanese Garden here at Cowra and also a director of Cowra Japan Society. And I've had involvement since 1981 in the Cowra Japan relationship. I was born in Cowra in 1945, given away my age. And I left school in 1960 and worked in Sydney for a couple of years. Then at age 18, I joined the Air Force. Came back to Cowra in 1969 and purchased a business with my brother. And 3 years later, I married a girl from Sydney, and she refused to go back to Sydney, so I'm still here in Cowra, and happily so.
So how did you kind of get involved with the Australian War Cemetery? Well, maybe I should ask you a broader question.
Yeah.
So how did you come to be involved?
Cowra-Japan relationship, yeah.
The whole peace and reconciliation story.
Yeah, well, in 1981... Don Kibler asked me to come onto the board of Cowra Tourism, which at the time was a controlling body for the Japanese Garden. Don Kibler was one of the founders of the Cowra Japanese Garden, and he in fact physically built stage two of the garden. He was a builder by trade. In 1981, Don Kibler, who was the president of Cowra Tourism at the time, asked me to join the board. Cowra Tourism was the governing body of the Japanese Garden, and I came onto the Japanese Garden Committee at that time as well. And one thing led to another. We travelled to Japan in 1984 and secured funding for stage two of the garden, which Don Kibler, as a builder, he did the construction in an honorary capacity.
Are you a member of RSL?
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that and the Australian War Cemetery and how, I'm interested, ever since I've known you, you've emceed there.
Yeah.
Commemorations. I'm interested in, how you started doing that as,
Well, I've been a member of the RSL for approximately 25 years, and we would often have Japanese groups visiting Cowra, and we would have a ceremony at the War Cemetery. And it was thought that we needed to be a little bit more formal. And I was asked to become the MC, and I continue to this day to do that job. The RSL originally cared for the graves at the Australian War Cemetery, and that was in 1946. They then looked over the fence and they looked at the Japanese graves and thought it would be a nice thing to maintain those as well. So the RSL has had a very long connection with the Cowra War Cemeteries.
But how did that come about, though? Did someone say, it was just after the war, so these were enemies.
That's right.
Can you just explain that? Because that's a hard thing for people to understand.
Well, apparently at an RSL meeting at that time, it was agreed that they would maintain the cemetery, and quite a few of the RSL members were farmers, and they had an affinity with the land, obviously, and they didn't like to see what was untidy. But also, some of them thought, well, it's a former enemy. It wasn't something that everybody agreed with at the time, but nevertheless, they did it. And in those days, they had to cart water there on a truck, and it was basic equipment, unlike today.
Is there anyone, I know that some people disagreed, but how, I guess I'm trying to figure in my head, were there a couple of people, key people, or was there sort of I mean, do you know anything about the dynamics that happened at the time? And as a member of here, I know you weren't there then, but, you know, can you explain to people who really don't even know about the Carol breakout how this happened? Because that RSL looking after the Japanese graves is like an impetus, right,
for
this whole piece, and we can see the repetition process.
Yeah.
Do you think you could elaborate a bit on that? And what do you think about
that? Yeah, well, I think it was the, you know, respect for the dead was the most important thing that came into it. I think, unfortunately, today there is no one within the RSL who was involved at that time. And even though we interviewed a number of people some 15 years ago, their memories weren't all that clear. So there's no great detail in respect of the RSL except the fact that they did maintain the Australian War Cemetery and the Japanese War Cemetery. And they did it on a voluntary basis. They had some sort of a roster system. It was probably one of the most important things that happened, although at the time it would not have been recognised. Australia didn't form diplomatic relations with Japan until the 1950s, somewhere about 1955, I think, when the Japanese embassy people visited Kara and visited the cemetery. And they were accompanied there by the then president of the RSL. So it was quite significant, and not a great deal happened then until 1964, when the Japanese War Cemetery was constructed similar to what it is today, and the maintenance then was taken over by the War Graves Commission based in Canberra.
Yeah, I just want to know, when you got involved in the early 80s, I guess we still had people like Bruce Buxton around, and how was Kara RSL viewed by the rest of the RSL in Australia?
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
Well, when I was asked to join the RSL, I was a little bit reluctant because I felt that, you know, maybe there would be some animosity. However, that didn't occur, and I found even at that time a number of the old World War II soldiers actually asked me questions about Japan and various other things, and I've never had any issue in respect of the RSL and my involvement with the Kara-Japan relationship.
Tell us about your emceeing, how you do it. We know, okay?
Yeah.
How you do it, and if you have any special memories attached to that.
Will I talk about the Governor General?
Yes, of
course.
Whatever you
want. Yeah. In 2016, the Governor General, Sir Peter Cosgrove, came here, and his protocol people told us beforehand that, you know, it's Sir Peter Cosgrove and Lady Cosgrove, and that's important. The Governor General got out of his car and he said, "Peter Cosgrove," put his hand out. He said, "My wife, Lynn." So the protocol went out the window. At the cemetery at the time, there were two Vietnam veterans, and Sir Peter Cosgrove he was a Vietnam veteran as well. When he saw them, he was quite animated. He said, "Oh, my boys." And he rushed down to meet them. And it turned out one of them had actually served with the Governor General in Vietnam. Yeah. So, and then we had a formal wreath-laying in both the Australian and the Japanese war cemeteries.
Can you tell us what happens in these commemorations? Just, you know, people gather, this last pause, wreath, you know, and then there's the youth reserve people, they do things. You can explain all of that and then how you take them to the Japanese cemetery.
Well, first up, in the Australian section, I give a brief introduction, explanation about who is buried here in the Australian section. We then have the formal wreath laying. The last post is played. The ode is recited and then reveille. From there, we move to the Japanese section. and same again, a brief introduction, and on occasions we have a Japanese choir. We have also a Buddhist priest chants the sutras, and we have the wreath laying, and then an inspection of the Japanese cemetery. It's a little difficult for people to understand at first because there are young children buried there and older people, as well as the Japanese soldiers who died in the breakout and the Japanese airmen who died in the raids on Northern Australia. So we have to explain that the children and the old people didn't die from conflict. They died from accidents or illness. And the Japanese government made a decision in the 1960s to have one war cemetery in Australia for all their war dead. So they were reinterred from various parts of Australia.
Just go back to the Australian War Cemetery. So here we I've just arrived, I'm a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm standing there, I've opened my app. What are some things that you want me to know about the Australian War Cemetery? Things about history? Is there something I need to look at?
Well, the four graves of the Australians who died in the breakout, Lieutenant Doncaster, Privates Hardy, Jones and Shepherd. Now, Privates Hardy and Jones were awarded the George Cross for bravery on the night of the breakout. Now, the George Cross and the George Medal were handed out by the British government, and the British government said, well, we'll give them a George Medal, which was much lower level. The Australian Prime Minister at the time, Robert Menzies, said, no, they will have the George Cross. Now, the George Cross is the highest civilian award. It's probably unprecedented for a soldier to receive. Another grave is an RAF airman. That's the British Air Force. And soon after the war, he was coming through Cowra on a motorbike and he had an accident. He was killed. And to my knowledge, is the last person buried in the Australian War Cemetery at Cowra. And his family have actually been out to visit his grave.
Why did he get buried then?
Sorry?
Why was he buried then?
Well, he was a former airman, and obviously authorities thought it was appropriate that he be buried in the war cemetery. One of the important things is often we have school students attending the ceremonies, and that's important because the young people need to understand and have the knowledge of what happened all those years ago, because we don't want history to repeat itself. I had this same conversation with Nakasone, the former Japanese Prime Minister, and he agreed. And therefore, yeah, education is a big thing. It'd be very easy in the future for future generations to not understand, and we could make the same mistakes again.
Can you remember the meeting Mr. Nakasone, and can you tell us that story?
Well, in 1985, we went to Japan. There was Ab Oliver, who was the chairman of the garden at the time. Don Kibler was the president of Cowra Tourism, and myself. And we had a meeting with Prime Minister Nakasone at his official residence. And on a later visit, after he had retired as Prime Minister, we met him again in his office. And that's where we had the discussion in respect of the importance of young people knowing about what happened. Now, I know that in Japan that's not a normal thing. Maybe it's changing now, but it certainly wasn't. I'm aware that it wasn't taught in the schools about World War II. But I with Mr. Nakasone, I mean, he was obviously a very open-minded man. And he hadn't visited Cowra, but he certainly had an understanding of it and an appreciation by actually meeting us when he was Prime Minister, which is quite exceptional, I thought, you know, three people from a little country town in Australia, you know. That evening we were taken to dinner by Michio Watanabe, who at the time was Minister for Trade. Same thing. He talked quite openly about trade between Japan and Australia. He told us the Japan was going to import more citrus and beef, and yeah, it was quite an experience to sit there and listen to such a powerful person, you know. Mm. They said about Michio, he wasn't prime minister, but he made them.
That's one of the things that really fascinates me about Kara, that it is this small town.
Exactly.
And people here go out and see powerful people. They come out here. The emperor comes out.
The emperor came out, that's right, yeah. Yeah. I remember, I wasn't involved, but where I lived at the time was just on the corner of the main road, and I saw his car going up to the cemetery. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. But, you know, why Cowra? Like, why did this happen in Cowra?
Well, the main thing is that the graves of the Japanese remained in Cowra. If those Japanese had been reinterred to Japan, I don't think we would have had a relationship with Japan. There wasn't anything to focus on. And then, of course, in the 1980s, when the Japanese Garden opened, that also became a focal point. And it's built from there with the peace bill and the exchange program, and so it goes on. And people, many people, have worked quite hard for this relationship. And you've got to remember, too, that in a small country town, like, we don't have government funding. If we go to Japan, it's at our own expense. Everything is in our own time. We're not being paid. And I think that probably appealed to the Japanese as well, the fact that people were so dedicated, you know, to this relationship. And then we built up, when we started Sakura Matsuri, that became another focal point. And then we were having the Japanese business people coming up from Sydney with their families, and Japanese coming from Canberra. So one thing has led to another.
So yeah. What's your role in that, in all of that?
My role?
What you see as your role.
Yeah. I was chairman of the garden for approximately 5 years, and I'm currently a director. So I just have that involvement and that interest, and also I'm contacted by a large number of Japanese from time to time, people that I've known in some cases for more than 30 years. There were two Japanese came here. They were ex-prisoners of war. They were both officers. And they'd been told by another former Japanese POW to contact me. And one fellow said that he actually worked for Japan Airlines, often came to Sydney, but he never mentioned that he'd been a prisoner in Cowra. His friend was a marine engineer. They came to Cowra just without any fanfare. They didn't want it to be known. It was interesting in that during the breakout, an officer was killed. Now, from the Australian side, it was said that this particular officer was going out to lead the breakout. Now, they didn't know that story, and they just said that their friend, who was a doctor, was killed. And they said he was standing out, you know, looking to see what was happening. So there were two sides to it, and they'd never been put together. The doctor would have been the last person who would be going out to lead the breakout. And then there was another Japanese I knew. He was, in later life, he was an artist. And he knew that he had to break out. So what he did, he went down Broadway, which is the main road in the camp, and he climbed into the officers' camp where he was safe. Yeah. So a number of these things that, you know, I've been told firsthand, which makes it, you know, more interesting. Yes, it's, well, anyway.
This might be a little bit of a difficult question, but it doesn't have to be.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Sometimes I find that, you know, those two cemeteries are next to each other. Uh-huh. Let's say you might have a Japanese tourist that comes to see the Japanese War Cemetery, and they walk straight past the Australian War Cemetery, don't pay their respects, and they go, just do the Japanese bit, have a look around, and they leave.
Yeah.
Not everybody, but there are people like that. In the same token, there may be just people who pay respects at the Australian War Cemetery and then just kind of have a look over at the Japanese and then leave without paying respects. It's not because they're necessarily feeling animosity or anything. It's just an interest. But I often feel that's being disrespectful. And I think that the two cemeteries are... Their paths have... You can't separate them. They're interconnected. Just wondered about how you felt about that.
Well, I think that because of the avenue of trees which leads to the Japanese cemetery, it tends to draw the people in without realising that above that is the Australian section. And but there have been occasions when people have refused to go into the Japanese War Cemetery. And I remember one RSL member, he said, I'm not going in there. But within a couple of years, he was coming in and joining the ceremonies. So it's just a process of education, I suppose, and give people time to think about it, you know. I certainly don't criticise anyone who goes to either cemetery and not to the other. However, when we have a ceremony, we always start in the Australian section because basically Australia is the host. Yeah. And, I mean, at times we do have to bring some of the Japanese back from the Japanese War Cemetery into the Australian section and say, well, we start here, you know. But they don't know the protocol, so we're not offended, not at all, no. And I think that's why we have an MC. We have one person responsible, one person in charge. So there's no confusion, yeah.
And that's you.
And that is myself at the present time, yeah.
What's your motivation? You said earlier on when you were going to Japan, you have to pay for yourself. I mean, you know, it's out of it's volunteer time that you don't get paid for. What motivates you? What keeps you doing this?
Well, I think it was an opportunity to do something entirely different, to embrace a different culture, and was something that appealed to me. Because in most country towns, it's pretty much the same old thing, but Cowra is just something different. And I suppose I saw an opportunity to become involved in something that was particularly interesting. And the response of the Japanese too, I mean, to go to Japan and be really looked after them, and the hospitality is unbelievable. It just appealed to me, yeah.
So you were young, you were opportunistic, you just wanted to get involved, but then what happened? What have you learned during this time?
What have I learned? I think I've learned to appreciate other people. But then bear in mind, when I went to school here in Cowra, there was a migrant camp, and in our class we had children from Eastern Europe, Germany, from everywhere, and we had Aboriginal children. So, and it was fine. You know, we didn't resent these foreign children. We used to call them bolts, but, you know, that wasn't anything in particular that we did that. So I suppose, in a way, I had a grounding at school for different cultures. I remember kids coming to school, boys coming to school in leather shorts. Well, we'd never seen leather shorts. And I think today how practical they were. They'd never wear out.
Insofar as the Australian War Cemetery in relation to this Australian War Cemetery is concerned, can you remember the happiest day and the saddest day?
Happiest day. It's always been a sense of achievement on those major anniversaries. We commemorated the 40th, 50th, 60th and 70th anniversaries, and they have been big events. They've got bigger each time, and we're now looking forward to the 75th anniversary next year. The support we get is fantastic, particularly from the council, Kara Council, and from the Japanese Embassy. And people actually come out from Japan for that celebration. Yeah.
How does that make you feel?
Well, being involved is a sense of achievement. Yeah. It's a little bit like we talked about Sakura Matsuri. Well, we had the first three Sakura Matsuris were pretty ordinary. The fourth one, we had then appointed a manager here at the Japanese Garden, and I was the chairman, and I wrote a new program for Sakura Matsuri, and unbelievably, the number of people that came. There were something like five or six coach loads from Sydney of Japanese people. The Japanese Embassy became involved virtually for the first time, and it's grown from there. And Sakura Matsuri is on next weekend, and we expect that it will be another very, very successful weekend.
So when you say you wrote the program, what was in the program?
Well, we have a tea ceremony, and we have kite flying, and we have Japanese food. What else? Ikebana. So we have. Judo, many.
Sumo?
Sumo, yep, we have sumo, yep, we do, yeah.
Can I ask you about sort of your feelings about Japan and, you know, growing up in Kara, you know, part of the Arisa, how have your feelings about Japan or Japanese people, I mean, has that changed? You know, has there been an evolution? You know, what have you learned from Japanese people or Japan?
I'm not sure how to answer that, actually, at the moment. Yeah.
It's kind of a big question.
But yeah.
I think we can come back to it.
Yep, we'll come back to that.
I would like to know what, if you know, being a Kara person, was there something else in your list you wanted to talk about?
No, I think we talked about the war cemetery, the RSL. Oh, we haven't talked about Joetsu yet. Yeah. Australian soldiers.
Okay, we'll do Joetsu later.
Yep.
Okay, we'll do Joetsu later.
Yep.
I want to ask about the peace thing. You know, we're doing this because we think that Kara is, you know, potentially or arguably the only peace tourism destination
in Australia.
In whole of Australia.
Mm.
Tell us about Kara and peace.
Kara and peace. No, I don't quite know how to answer that.
Okay.
I was going to tell you something about the Japanese war cemetery. Back when Japan re-established diplomatic relations with Australia, there was a move to reinter the Japanese graves to Japan. But the Ministry for Health and Welfare, which are responsible for graves, they said, oh, there are no prisoners. There were no prisoners in Kara. Japanese are not taken prisoner. And they didn't want to have anything to do with it. Now, a diplomat called Yamazaki, who was at the Japanese embassy in Canberra, he was given responsibility to sort this out. And it was felt that the families in Japan wouldn't accept the remains of their loved ones because they had been prisoners of war and the feeling of the Bushido code and all that type of thing. So that's when the decision was made to have one cemetery in Australia for all the war dead. I know some people say because of the care given by the Kara people, that's the reason. But the real reason, now we didn't know that until about probably 20 years ago when Yamazaki revisited Kara. And he called me aside at the war cemetery and explained. And that's the first we've heard of it. Now, he only told two people. He told myself and Don Kibler. So we have that. And I read, you know, about the care of the graves as the reason that they're in Cowra, et cetera, et cetera, but that's not the real reason. Now, Yamazaki went on to become the ambassador, Japanese ambassador in the UK. I think he's since passed away, but it was great to have that story firsthand and to know. Yeah. So.
But that's a big thing to be given.
Mm.
Because yeah, I'm sure you know a little bit about when Japanese buried all the sort of the souls of the Japanese people are here.
Yeah.
It's quite a big responsibility.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit the same with Ken Nakajima, who designed this Japanese garden. And to his mind, the Australian soul is represented by the gum trees, and that's why he wanted to leave the gum trees in the garden. We didn't know that. And in his mind also, the spirits of the dead Japanese would descend to the big rock that's in the back of the garden on the northern side. And Ken said that's the reason he selected the site for the Japanese garden, right here. And another was a rock, a conical-shaped rock, which Ken said was the anchor for the garden, which he said has been there for thousands of years waiting for a garden to be built. The same thing. We didn't know all this until some years after the garden was built. And Ken Nakajima said, well, look, you've been to Japan and you understand a little. He said, I'll explain to you now. And he did. And I kept diary notes of all those meetings with Ken Nakajima. But unfortunately, today is only Don Kibler and myself are the only two that are still alive that had any close relationship with Ken. So we often quote Ken. I'm sure people get fed up with us quoting Ken, but, you know, Ken was the guru. He wrote the Bible for this garden. Mm.
You didn't answer the question about the happiest day.
He wrote the happiest day, sort of his sense of achievement. But
sense of achievement.
I didn't get the saddest day from him.
Saddest day? No, well, I don't think there have been any sad days as such that I could say. I mean, the families of the dead Japanese came here, and at the cemetery they were obviously very emotional, and that touches you a bit. And also the families of the dead Australian soldiers have been here, and you can imagine the emotions that they are going through. One woman, her father was Private Shepherd. Now, and her story is interesting in that her mother wasn't able to care for the children after the husband was killed, and the children were placed in an orphanage. And this lady has been back to Cowra quite often, and you really feel for her to think that the father was killed on duty and the family weren't looked after. So there was a failing there somewhere. So, you know, from both sides, there's been emotional times at the cemetery. I wouldn't say they were sad times, but certainly emotional. Mm.
Did you go to the Australian War Cemetery as a child? Do you remember any?
No, I don't actually. I can remember probably about age 12 or 13, and one of the boys at school told me that in his house there were bullet holes came through the roof, and I thought, oh, that's a bit far-fetched. And I found out in many years later there was a house down below the campsite, and there was, in fact, machine gun bullets went through the roof of that house. Yeah. So, but no, I didn't know anything about it. And while I was away in the Air Force, I picked up a book about the Cowra breakout. And I thought, gee, I should know about that. I've come from Cowra, but that's the first that I had actually known about it. Yeah.
Do you think Cowra's changed as a result of these sort of efforts to reconcile with Japan, you know, bring the Japanese and be friends with the Japanese? Do you think it's...
Oh, I think it's certainly changed. And many Kara people have been to Japan, which you certainly wouldn't find in other country towns of this size. And they've formed close relationships. I mean, last weekend they had the what they call Core Farmer, which is the choir from Tokyo Agricultural University, who have been coming here for something like 40 years and stay with the same host families every time. So that in itself is quite significant. Mm.
Now, you talked a lot about the Japanese cemetery, but I'm just wondering if we can, because you've been chosen by, I think, Paul and Lawrence to talk about the Australian War Cemetery. Did you want to say anything else about that?
That some 25 years ago, the Korean Society in Sydney were looking to have a memorial here in Cowra because the Koreans and the Formosans were co-opted into the Japanese army, and some of the graves at the cemetery are in fact Korean and Formosan. There was one comment from a Japanese saying, well, they're all in the Japanese army, so that, you know, that's basically it. Leave it at that. And then the Koreans sort of lost interest for whatever reason, I don't know. But they were very enthusiastic at one time, and the council had indicated that, yes, an area could be made available there for the Korean memorial, but it hasn't happened. Mm.
There's some kind of a power tool going on.
Yeah.
There is, yeah. Yeah, they're working. I can't think of any more to say about the Australian War Cemetery. I do recall seeing photos that were taken in the Japanese War Cemetery at the time of a burial, and a number of Australian soldiers were there, and they paid their respects. You could see that the way they were standing and their hats off, and yeah.
It's a bit loud.
So let's talk about, did you want to ask about the jewels?
Yeah.
Yes, we'd like you to talk to us about that. So.
I read an article in an American military magazine, and it was about a chap called Matt Clift, who lived in Cowra, and it told of his wartime experience in Joetsu. And so I arranged to go on. Oh, he started again.
So you're talking about Matt Clift?
Matt Clift, yeah. And I arranged to go and see Matt Clift, and he told me his story about his imprisonment at Joetsu in Niigata. And I resolved the next trip to Japan I would go to Joetsu. Now, during the war years, the camp was in a town called Noetsu, but in later years they combined two cities to form Joetsu. So I went to Japan, up to Joetsu, and I met with the mayor, and I suggested the planting of gum trees as a memorial to the Australians, and also to organise a memorial service. And that was in February of 1988. And I went back again in May of 88, and I took with me another Australian who had been a prisoner of war in Noetsu. And Father Tony Glynn from NARA had organised for the service. And so that was the first post-war connection with Joetsu. Now, the people from Joetsu came out here to Cowra. They could see what had occurred in Cowra since the war, and that spurred them on, and they then wanted to build a commemorative garden, which they did, and a relationship formed between Cowra and Joetsu. They now have a formal friendship agreement with council. I think that's about it, basically. Yeah, can't think of anything else.
Can you just go back and just explain, just a quick sentence, that there was a POW camp in Noetsu in Japan?
So oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. The POW camp in Noetsu, there were 300 Australians, 60 died in the first probably 18 months. Now, one of the men was from Cowra, was a fellow called Alan Healy, and he's now buried in Yokohama War Cemetery. So there were a lot of similarities between Cowra and Noetsu. No, it's an interesting story, and I think it was that visit, or the two visits in 1988, that gave the people of Joetsu an opportunity. Even though they were how many years behind Cowra, they certainly became enthusiastic. And they had some issues there too, because the families of some of the Japanese guards who'd been executed for war crimes were quite anti that Japan was going to commemorate Australian soldiers who died there. But to my knowledge, it is the only memorial in Japan to Australians. Yeah, so it is unique. It's as Cowra is unique to the Japanese. Yeah. But well, it was my initiative that formed that post-war relationship, and that continues today.
I think
we've got everything.
Got everything?
Yeah.
Have you?
But there is one thing I just want to ask. It won't be part of the app, but I'm still kind of curious as to we spoke to Don Kibler last time we were here, but you know, he was saying the same thing, that he spent a lot of his own money.
Yeah, yeah, he did. Yeah, yeah.
Why do you do it? It's a big thing, right? It's a big thing to do all of this.
Well, it is, I guess, but, well, I certainly didn't look at it that way. No, I just saw it as an opportunity to do something different. And then, of course, I got a sense of achievement out of it, you know.
That's different from the sense of achievement you've had through your work or through your family? Or
Different again. And it's... I don't know how to explain it, actually. It just... I guess it's like a Japanese moving to Australia. Everything is completely different. And there are certain aspects that you think, gee, that's fantastic. I really want to get involved in that. And the more you get involved, well, yeah, the more interesting it becomes. But I think it was the people in Japan too that made it, you know, they were so friendly, so open. Unbelievable hospitality, yeah. And also meeting, you know, coming from a small country town and meeting these important people on the world stage. No, that's all. I really can't explain it properly. It's just one of those things that I decided that I wanted to be involved in. And I want to continue, yeah, yeah. No, I've got no regrets at all. I'm very pleased that I did it. And, of course, I did receive recognition from Japan and from Australia. And that's another achievement, I guess, for someone in my circumstances to be recognised in that way.
What do you mean, your circumstances?
Well, I mean, when you leave school at 15 with a pretty basic education, but with an open mind. And then I had to make my own opportunities because my family didn't have anything. And I wanted to be independent, which I've achieved. Even though at 73 years of age, I still work, but only because I want to. I don't have to, you know. That's me, though. I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared to just sit on the fence and not go anywhere. Yeah. So it was a bit the same with the Japanese thing. I saw an opportunity to achieve, and that's what I did. And I did the same in my own private life, and I'm quite happy with that. I'm more than happy with the situation that I'm in. There's no way that I expected to to be recognised by two governments. And I say to people, well, there are only two ex-Air Force people have an Order of the Rising Sun. I said, one is Gough Whitlam and the other is me. So, yeah.
That's a huge issue.
Yeah, yeah. It's, that I, and I've got a friend in Canberra, he retired from the Air Force as Deputy Chief. He was an Air Vice Marshal. And he actually went to school in Cowra. And he only rang me a couple of weeks ago and asked me for a bit of advice on something. And I said, well, there's not many ex-Air Force corporals give advice to Air Vice Marshals. You know what I mean? That's the thing. I didn't have any resentment towards other people, other nationalities, or people of high rank, or I was open-minded, and if they accepted me, that was fine. If they didn't, well, it didn't matter, you know. Yeah.
And just one last thing about the legacy. So you've had these personal achievements, but do you think is your legacy to Cowra, to future of Cowra, young people?
What's my legacy? No, I don't know. I haven't got an answer. It disappoints me that young people that they leave school, they don't do anything, they don't, you know. I say to young people, look, you know, just get a job. Get a job, any job. And if you don't like it, doesn't matter. Or join the military. Find your way. Yeah. And because there's so many young people that they don't get the opportunity or they can't see the opportunity. Whereas in my case, I was determined to make the opportunity, and I did, in a lot of respects. I wouldn't say that I didn't get lucky. I just had a rare determination that, you know, I was going to succeed one way or the other. Yeah. So I achieved in my personal life and in my business life. Yeah.